How do you calculate correlation? If I gave you two series, how would you calculate correlation? You'd say, okay, here's series 1, here's series 2, and you'd simply apply the Excel function in correlation. And if it's the same series, you will end up with, okay, you'd end up with 1. What is correlation? What's the formula for correlation? So covariance between A and B divided by sigma A and sigma B. One of the things that we do when we want to calculate the correlation of a portfolio or the standard deviation of a portfolio, how do we calculate that? Let's assume you have a portfolio of 100 positions. So you have A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, Z, and then double A, double B, double D, so on and so forth, like Excel. If you have a portfolio of 100 positions, then how would this expand? Not very nicely, right? To calculate the volatility of the portfolio, you create something called a variance, covariance matrix, which is one way of looking at or working with portfolio volatility. And what we will do is that rather than getting into the actual detailed process of building a variance covariance matrix, which would get very cumbersome and difficult if you have very large portfolios, we'll actually use a shortcut. And what the shortcut will do is allow us to quickly calculate the volatility of any portfolio using some of the tools and techniques that we've already used yesterday. Right? So that's one thing that we want to do today. So the first method, the variance covariance method, is reliant on this assumption, and for this to work, it needs portfolio volatility. The shortfall with this method is that, as we saw yesterday, the world that we work with, specifically when it comes to asset prices, is not normal. It's something else. We're not sure what is the appropriate name for that something else, but we are sure that it's not normal. The second approach that you work with, which is historical simulation, this approach is the same approach that we used yesterday when we built the histogram, when we actually looked at the distribution. And when we looked at the distribution, what did we do? We said, how many points do I have where the price shock is more than 5%? How many points do I have where the price shock is more than 10%? How many points do I have where the price shock is more than 12%, so on and so forth, right? So rather than using and guessing and applying the normal distribution, we assumed that the underlying distribution was not normal, and we actually looked at the true distribution, the actual distribution. So if you use that approach, you end up with historical simulations. We'll use this also. And the third and final piece is Monte Carlo simulation. Monte Carlo, to be fair, is just a fancier, more exciting extension of the first approach. This is variance covariance. And the reason why I say that it's more fancy or exciting is because you need an estimate of volatility. And then once you have that estimate, you apply that estimate to build a world, or rather simulate a world, which is normal. If I have a choice of using historical simulation, variance covariance, and Monte Carlo, my preference as a practitioner is to always go with which one? Historical. Why? Because it follows the true distribution. I will only use Monte Carlo when I have no other choice, when I have no related price data that I can work with to calculate historical returns. But if I have a choice, I will always prefer to use historical simulation. So one of the things we want to do today is we want to go through all three approaches very, very quickly, very, very briefly, and build them so that we are clear in our mind how different are the results when it comes to this specific approach. The second piece that we have to do, which we'll actually do earlier before we open Excel spreadsheets, is we need to walk through a simple transaction where a customer is asked for advice on hedging their exposure, and you as an advisor, as a consultant, as a banker have gone to see them, right? The example that we're looking at is crude oil refineries. The first question, the question that all of you asked, some of you asked me feedback on or about, was how do you calculate probabilities? You've all done micro, right? Microeconomics. You understand the concept of break-even analysis? So take the concept of break-even, but flip it. Break-even focuses on how much do we need to buy, sell, purchase, manufacture, produce, so that our costs are covered. Similar to break-even is the concept of what we call shortfall. It's also known as the probability of ruin, R-U-I-N. Now, the shortfall method asks the same question, but in a different way. Shortfall question asks, if I have $600 million in income, of which $400 million are my expenses, I have a profit margin of $200 million. So question I'm asking is, how much do prices need to move for this margin to hit zero or even turn negative? So yesterday what you did was you said, okay, I have a price series. On that price series I can find out what the volatility is. Using that volatility I can apply the normal distribution to find out what the price shock would be. The question I'm now trying to ask is, what price shock would break the bank? What price movement would break either Air Canada or GM? And then once I find out what that price shock is, what is the probability, what is the likelihood of that price shock occurring? Same concept as break-even analysis, but flipped. Rather than focusing on how much do we need to cover our fixed costs, we're saying how much do prices need to move for us to get into trouble. So for example, if I assume that a dollar change in prices of the underlying commodity, whether it is Canadian dollar, whether it is fuel oil, whether it is WTI, whether it is gold, if I assume that a dollar change in prices will lead to an added expense of, let's assume, $30 million. Prices need to move by about $7 for me to add another $210 million in expenses, holding everything else constant. If I use this as a basis of $210 million, then all I need to find out is what's the likelihood, what's the possibility of pricing moving by $7. Let's assume prices are $3. Let's also assume that volatility is 50% for a year, for a 12-month period. If we do it by 3, we end up at 150. If we multiply it by, let's say, 5, we end up with 2.5. If prices move by $7, you will be at $10 of the commodity. If I use 3, which is 99.9 percentile, normal distribution factor, if I do 3 at 50% volatility, the factor would become 1.5. This is annualized volatility. If I add another $7 in prices, I'll eat away all of my margin. If current prices are at 3, annual volatility is 50%, 3 times 50% will give me a factor of 1.5. 1.5 times 3 is how much? A maximum shock of 4.5. What about 2.5? So if I take a factor of 5, 1.5 times 5, 0.5 into 5 is 2.5. 2.5 into 3 will give me 7.5. So the question then becomes, what is the factor, what is the probability of getting multiplied by 5? And this number would turn out to be, I think, 99.99999%. If this is the corresponding norm SINV number, then what's the probability? It's 1 minus. All right, so now, before we move forward, does this make sense? Did everybody follow what we've done? If you go through it step by step, what have we done? The thesis is we want a model that allows us to estimate probabilities that margins will decrease. If you take the extreme end, we're saying, what's the probability that the margin is less than zero? That the margins are actually negative. My current numbers are, I make $600 million in income. I have $400 million in expenses. So I'm left with a margin of 200. Now I have a price series for, what's the commodity? The commodity is fuel oil. A price series for fuel oil that says that for a full year, the standard deviation, the volatility is 50%. I also know that current prices right now are at $3. My margin is 200. I'm assuming in this specific case that for every dollar fuel oil goes up, I will spend additional $30 million. If fuel oil goes up by a number greater than $7 in the next 12 months, I will get to a point where I'll spend an additional $210 million in fuel costs. If I spend this amount, this margin will turn negative and my net number, assuming everything else is held constant, will be minus 10. Question we are asking is, what is the probability of this happening? So how do we go out and calculate this probability? So we go out and say, I have a very simple model. That model says, this is the distribution of changes in fuel oil prices. This model at inception, at the beginning, has a standard deviation of 50% per year, which means one standard deviation move is 50%, two standard deviation move is 100%, three standard deviation move is 150%, four standard deviation move is 200%, five standard deviation move is 250%. So now I'm saying for me to go under, for my margin to become and turn negative, prices have to travel how far a distance? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Prices have to travel 5 standard deviations for me to end up with a margin of minus 10. If prices travel by 5 standard deviation, I will spend another additional $210 in expenses and my margin will turn negative. Standard deviation is 50%. 50 into 5 is 2.5. 2.5 into 3 is 7.5. So this will give us 7.5. The number that you want is actually a little less than 7. So we'll adjust it accordingly. But for argument's sake, for simplicity's sake, we're assuming we're looking at a 5 standard deviation move. What we're doing right now is we're doing very basic work. And the reason for doing it in this way is we want to make sure that the fundamental principle is clear. Once the principle is clear, we'll actually extend and say, you actually go and present in front of clients, what do you present? So we haven't gotten that part as yet. What we're now doing is saying, first tool in our toolkit is the shortfall method. And that's what we've used. We've used the shortfall method to estimate the probability that your margins will be negative, which is different from, you asked, right? Navin asked. Which is different from the probability that the price shock would be exceeded. So now that we've done this piece, and we've only done this piece for one specific scenario, there are more questions that we need to answer. In this specific case, we'd made assumptions. We'd made assumptions that you actually have a profit of $200 million. We've made assumption that a dollar increase will lead to $30 in addition. Maybe this is not $30. Maybe this is $50 or $60. And if that's the case, then you do sensitivity on each of these elements. And then you do analysis which is on a range of each of these. Now that we've done this, and that we've done the basic work, we want to look at a simple case study of how did we apply this method to an oil refinery to figure out what the drivers were, what the exposure was, and what the sensitivities were, and then what was the final, okay, and what was presented. So you're an oil refinery. What do? How does an oil refinery work? Buys crude oil, right? Okay. So now, how does this work? How does this process work? Let's say you're a refinery in Tokyo, in Japan. So if you're a refinery in Tokyo, this is about a 15-hour journey by air. Is it a good idea to ship oil by air? No, right? You ship it, right? You ship it using something called a VLCC, which is a very large crude carrier. And ships come in different sizes. Let's assume that a typical refinery in Japan buys crude oil in bulk. So it buys anywhere between 50,000 tons to 100,000 tons. 1 ton of oil costs how much? About $700 to $900. I am a refinery in Japan, and here's my supplier in, let's say my supplier, because you're sitting in UAE, is ADNOC. So Abu Dhabi is the port. How long does it take for a ship to go from Abu Dhabi to Tokyo? How long does it take for you to load 100,000 tons of oil in a ship? So think about this. I've bought 100,000 ton of oil. I have a ship right next to Abu Dhabi that's waiting for me to give confirmation. So I give the confirmation, I go ahead and sign the paperwork, I send it over. Once I do that, the ship first docks in Abu Dhabi, then will load, will then depart. Will the ship be docked and ready to load when I buy the oil? No. I'll have to buy the oil first. Ship will be under contract, but it'll be on it. So I buy the oil, everything is fine, in order. It's about 3 days. If I'm assuming that it takes me a day to load the oil. It might take a little longer. So between 3 to 4 days in landing, loading, and departure. When the ship gets here to Japan, what happens here? You're not instantly unloaded, right? Again, same process. Day to load, day to unload, and so on and so forth. And where will it unload? Will it unload at the refinery stock, or will it actually unload at the liquid fuel storage port? It'll unload at the port, and from the port, there's a pipeline, depending on the nature and type of oil, that will take it to the refinery, right? So about 5 days here till the oil actually gets to the refinery after the ship is near the port. So 5 days here and 3 days here. That's about 8 days. What about the distance between here and here? What's the nautical distance between Abu Dhabi and Tokyo? So let's make an assumption. Dubai to New York is 7,000 kilometers. 7,000, how much does a crude carrier travel at? VLCC travels at a speed of, let's say, 10 knots an hour. In a day, it'll do 240 knots. So 7,000 miles by 240 is how much? About 30 days? It's about a month. So 30 days. This is all assumptions, right? So about 30 days. Looking at about a 40-day window. Here's the challenge. When you buy crude oil, it takes 40 days for that oil to come to you, to actually get to you, right? Before you can do something with it. Then you refine it. How long does it take you to refine 100,000 tons of oil? Depends on the capacity of the refinery. Let's assume it takes 3 to 5 days. Now, what happens when you refine the crude? What do you produce? You produce refined product. You produce petrochemical product. The biggest is gasoline. Then there's fuel oil. Then there's diesel. Then there's naphtha. Then there's lots of other stuff that falls into derivative products. And then there are further products that are dried from the petrochemical process. So let's say it takes you about another 3 to 5 days to process this, and another 3 to 5 days for you to take these produce, stuff that you produced, and get it in front of your customers, where they will buy it. So your end-to-end cycle is how many days? So somewhere between 50 to 60 days from the point that you purchase at a price, and you're able to sell. And what are you selling? You're not selling the same barrel of crude oil. You're selling derivative products. If crude oil prices go up, do derivative prices also go up? Here's the correlation. So just like trailing volatility, we also calculate trailing correlation, which in this specific case shows that the linkage between a derivative product, which is fuel oil in this case, and crude oil is actually negative. There's no assurance, there's no guarantee that prices go up and your prices also go up. So what has the refinery done? The refinery has bought 100,000 tons of oil, crude oil, at $1,000 a ton. So 100,000 into 1,000 is $100 million. For the next 60 days, it's not going to produce anything. It's out of pocket for this amount. It's exposed to this amount. At the end of 60 days, when it's produced, it will know what is the relevant price at which it can sell. So its primary exposure is that in that 60-day period, if prices go up or prices come down, what will happen? Does it care about crude oil prices going up? Does it care about the final refined product prices going up or coming down? It doesn't care about both, because once it's bought it, if crude oil prices go up, this inventory that it has on its book for 60 days will go up in value. And the product that it will produce in those 60 days will also hopefully go up in value. If there's the inverse relationship holds, which is what we've seen, then if crude oil prices go up, think in terms of risks and exposures. You actually have 4 or 5 things to worry about. Okay, let's make a list of all the things that can go wrong. Number one, crude oil prices go up. They go up, your 100 million also goes up. Refined products, such as fuel oil and gasoline, go down. So while you bought it at this level, when you finally produce it and sell it, you will not be able to sell it at full price. Second scenario, crude oil prices go down and refined prices also go down. So this inventory that you have in work in progress comes down in value, and the inventory that you're producing also comes down in value. Third scenario, nothing happens to crude oil prices. They stay the same, but refined products come down. And then the fourth scenario is crude oil prices go nowhere, refined product prices also go nowhere. So this is your best case, because your costing doesn't change. So now from a refinery's point of view, there are two separate challenges. The first challenge is you have crude inventory that goes up and down in value. And because you do reporting on a quarterly basis, if you bought the crude in the middle of the quarter and right towards the end of the quarter, crude oil prices fell and your inventory is marked to market, what happened? And if you're a refinery, refineries open how many days in a year? There is a time where it's being turned around, where it's being shut down for maintenance. Let's assume that's about 2 months, right? So it's open for about 10 months. It's open for 10 months. If it's a refinery that produces about 100,000, processes about 100,000 tons of oil on a daily basis, it's open 10 months into 30, about 300 days. It's open 300 days, and it takes 60 days for the end-to-end batch to get processed. How many batches do you think are there in transit at a given point in time? At least 50 days worth? So it'll buy one batch of 100,000 ton, then buy another batch of 100,000 ton, then buy another batch of 100,000 ton, right? And they'll all be sort of staggered, so that the first batch comes in, gets processed, the next comes in, gets staggered, then the third comes in. So it has about, let's say, 50 batches. If it has 50 batches of 100,000 tons, how many tons is that? So So 5 million tons. 5 million tons at 100 is how much? $500 million. So it has exposure to $500 million worth of crude oil that's basically effectively floating in the sea, and which will get marked to market at the end of every quarter. Is that good or bad? Now, prices go up and down, right? You buy it at 80, prices go up to 84, come back to 80, that's fine. You buy it at 80, prices go up to 85, come down to 70, that's also fine. But you bought at 110 and prices come down to 80, that's a 30% markdown. So $500 million, 30% markdown, how much is that? $150 million, right? So now what's the exposure? But this is just crude oil, right? What about refinery? What about refined products? If you're processing 100,000 barrels a day and you have the capacity to store another 100,000, how many days of storage would you have of refined products? One is crude oil, one is refined products. So you produce stuff, how many days of storage would you keep? So if you keep 30 days of storage, and let's assume there is no loss, so you have about 100,000 tons being produced every day, you have how many? You have 3 million tons. So 5 million tons of crude, 3 million tons of refined. And this is all open to, what's the risk? Price. Price going up or coming down? Price is coming down. Price is coming down and being marked to market in your accounting statements at the end of every quarter. Would you like to hedge this risk? If you were the CFO of the refinery, if you were the risk manager of the refinery, you would want to hedge this risk, right? So question that we have to ask, and this is the same question that you will have to ask yourself when we discuss the Air Canada case and the GM case and the Bank One case and the LDCM case, is where do we figure out what is the right way of finding out what part of this exposure should be hedged? So both Air Canada and GM say it's 50%, 75%, but why? How do you? To do this, you actually have to take a step back and again go look at the process and figure out the same calculation that we did on the board earlier with respect to shortfall. Apply the same calculation and analysis on how much would these price sensitivities actually translate in terms of P&L hit. Here's the range of percentiles from 99 percentile to 51 percentile. And then we said, what's the price shock? But we did the price shock twice. We said there is a low stable wall world in which volatility is at the lower end, and then there is a high wall world in which volatility is at its peak. Let's do our analysis on both. And then we said, what is the dollar magnitude of inventory losses in a given period across this range? And then we said, what is the dollar magnitude of inventory losses in the high wall world? So the question that we put to the board in this specific instance was, when I say 51 percentile, what are the odds? The odds are almost even. There is a 1:1 chance. You should see this change almost every other day. So then we ask them, you know, what is the most common change that you see? Because that will give us an indication, an idea of how to calibrate what we have in front of us with the market that they operate in. And they said that the most common change that we see is a change of about $26. What does $26 relate to? It actually relates to 66 percentile. And where again the odds are now not even, it's now 1:2. So one chance of happening, two chances of not happening. What is the loss that corresponds to this level? Corresponds to about $2 million per quarter in the low vol world and about $7 million per quarter in the high vol world. And this is a small refinery. So the amount of, the tonnage that you have is not that big, not that high. So how do you present this? How do you make a decision on the basis of these numbers that you see in front of you? The question you're asking to yourself is, if I am a board member of this refinery, am I comfortable with seeing a direct hit to my P&L because of mark-to-market losses of about $7 million at least 6 to 8 times in a given month? What we're trying to do is, we sort of gone out and created a curve, a path or a grade, and we're saying pick the grade that you're comfortable with. And the board came back and said, okay, 3 million we can live with. Anything above doesn't make sense. So the board says we can live with 3 million, then this becomes a threshold. In the GM case, when you say you're covering 50% or 75%, you're effectively saying we're okay with taking half the exposure on ourselves. and only covering the remaining half. You all have health insurance in the way, right? Have you looked at the language of your health insurance forms? Somewhere in there it says expenses up to this level will not be covered and beyond this level will be covered, right? That's called a deductible. Same thing that's applied to your automobile insurance back home in India. So the deductible in this case set by the board is 3 million and the level of coverage, the protection that you want to buy starts above this level, starts above a price shock of $16 per ton in the low vol world and $40 per ton in the high vol world. So the protection that you want will only kick in once in the low vol world by $16, in the high vol world by $40. If you look at crude volatility, which is what this graph shows you, you can actually see that crude goes all the way up to about 8% in terms of volatility and comes down to about 2%. This is 06 to 09. But is there more? Has what we done enough, or is there more that could be done that should be incorporated or included in our analysis? So let's look at this. Your primary issue is exposure in terms of the lag between purchase and product arrival for distribution. If you're regulated, price sensitive to the pricing that's set by the market price regulator, which is in most cases the oil and gas authority. The market regulator links prices to international crude prices, which may be completely different from the lag that you're facing in terms of purchase and delivery. And then there is a 30-day lag in every price reset. When you buy, this is what makes it even more interesting, when you buy crude from ADNOC, how do you think pricing works? So today is the third of the month. I'm now buying 100,000 ton batch every day for the next 30 days. When I buy the batch, do I know what the price is? When you buy from ADNOC, ADNOC says buy it. Buy it for the next 30 days. Keep on buying it. The actual cost of what you bought will be determined and set at the end of the month. So there is also price uncertainty at the time of purchase, which means that even if I buy on the 3rd and the 4th and the 5th, I don't know whether I bought it at $700 a ton, $650, $690, $725, $780, $800, or $900. It's a function of what happens to prices in that month. So I'll buy it now. My pricing will only be locked in on the 30th, at the end of the month, when ADNOC comes out and says that pricing for the month of June, for batches sold and delivered in the month of June, is X. So what's happening now will get decided at the end of the month. That's how ADNOC works. Now, there are different other suppliers who have different pricing mechanisms in place, but for a second, let's just assume that you have uncertainty of both sides, pricing on this side and pricing on that side. If you review the process that we've gone through, we've said price fix, then there is manufacturing process time, potential exposure, and the P&L impact of that exposure. Now, the assumption is that the refinery that we're working with produces high sulfur fuel oil, okay? So the 32% of the mix is high sulfur fuel oil, naphtha, motor gas, which is gasoline, high octane, which is HOPC, kerosene, aviation fuels, high speed diesel, and low speed diesel. So each barrel of oil or each ton of oil that the refinery uses produces about 32% goes in HSFO, 19% goes in motor gas, only a small, I think 0.29% goes in HOPC, 2.6% in kerosene, 10% in aviation fuels, 33% in high-speed diesel. Why is this relevant? This is relevant because you're now getting to refined products. In the first part, we only looked at crude. Now we're saying, okay, if I need to calculate my exposure to refined products, what's the relationship? What does a barrel or a ton of oil generate and produce? Okay. Then we look at what is the price change or the range of price changes. So the period in question here, the range is minus 27% to plus 14%. Once again skewed, is it normal? Not normal, right? And then what about the output price change? This is the input price change. Look at the output price change. The output price change is negative 44%. Minus 44% to plus 10%. Is it normal? And then what's the margin change? So that's the interesting piece. The first piece, the first table that I showed you, only focused on crude. This table actually shows that if you look at historical data, look at historical changes in margins over a time frame, you're looking at a margin impact of about minus 14% to 35%. And this is in an unhedged world. So despite all of this volatility over the last 5 years or so, the net impact of all of these changes is still minus 14%. That's your exposure. How does that translate into numbers? First chart that you saw showed you crude oil changes. This one does a little things a little bit differently. So it's saying input price shock, high and low, and the impact of the input price shock on margin shortfall. How much do margins change, not just inventory, how much do margins change based on price shocks? And your worst case scenario is a reduction of 63%. Your best case scenario is no reduction. The board now has two different questions. The first question is, how much do you want to lose in inventory losses? Second question is, what percentage of reduction are you comfortable with in your P&L? I'm fine with 3, 6, 10, 14. So about here, I get a little concerned. If my margins reduce by 22%, things start getting a little uncomfortable. So this corresponds to a threshold of 80%. So from a protection point of view, I now have two dimensions. The first dimension is crude oil prices and my inventory loss based on those crude oil prices. Second dimension is if I translate that crude oil loss into margin impact, I'm looking at a margin reduction of 22%. So from a philosophy point of view, from a policy point of view, from a protection point of view, from a product point of view, I want a solution that would restrict changes in my profitability to about 22% on account of an input price shock. That's the solution that I want. How are you going to create it? Will it be enough to just buy a forward contract on crude oil? Will that fix it? You've done the analysis, right? You've done the exposure measurement. You've figured out how much the board can lose, how much the board is comfortable in losing. The board has decided, they've said, you know, 22%, this is what we want. Buy your protection. How are you going to buy this protection? How are you going to structure it? Advice is fine and well. So after doing all of this analysis, after, you know, spending 10 days locked in a boardroom with the board members, you said, okay, we've all agreed on protection. The question we're now asking is, how are you going to implement this protection? If you were to go out and buy a product for protection, what is that product linked to? It's linked to WTI and Brent. You don't have a solution that gives you protection against Upper Zakum or Marban or Saudi Aramco or Iranian Heavy. There is no liquid market for these solutions. So what do you do now? So think about this. Based on what I've just shared, how would you move forward with analyzing the two cases, Air Canada and GM?